It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at Ting.com/Majority Report.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 2nd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Nan Aaron, president of the Alliance for Justice, on both the upcoming term of the Supreme Court and what we need to do as progressives to deal with the Supreme Court. You got affirmative action on the block, the chopping block, the Civil Rights Act on the chopping block, and who knows what else now that John Roberts has dealt a blow to the Commerce Clause. All that and more in Nan Aaron. J.P. Morgan sued by Eric Schneiderman. Is it a big deal? Tomorrow night, big debate. Zingers will be flying, but not from President Obama. Also on today's program, more on the fiscal cliff, the potential for a grand bargain. Some issues on voter registration. Noam Chomsky, I know for a lot of you who don't listen to the better half of the program, you're completely unawares as to the massive amount of debate that goes on there about the presidential election. What's the best way to get a third party going? Blah, blah, blah. Noam Chomsky weighed in with an interview with Matthew Filipovich. We will talk about that in this program. But first off, some good news, ladies and gentlemen. This is 2 days in a row I've started off with good news. A judge in Pennsylvania, you will recall that we were waiting to hear from a judge in Pennsylvania on not the state constitutionality of Pennsylvania's voter ID law, but rather, after the state Supreme Court had sent it back down to a judge, rather whether or not this law could be implemented between now and the presidential election in a fair and constitutional way relative to the state Supreme Court. Could it be executed in the way that it was legislated? And today, just moments ago, a judge postpones Pennsylvania new tough voter ID requirement, ordering that it not be enforced in the presidential election. Today's ruling comes just 5 weeks before the election. An appeal is possible. However, in my completely uninformed and barely educated opinion, I would say it's highly unlikely that by the time this gets to appeal, somebody would overturn it because this was sent back down to the, by the Supreme Court saying, make a determination on this. The facts are fairly well stated and clear. And all that's going to happen on appeal is you're going to have even less time to actually execute this law. So as it stands now, the voter ID law in Pennsylvania will not be in effect for this presidential election. So that's good news. There's going to be a whole lot less people disenfranchised, although the right wing has achieved some of its goal in that it's probably scaring some people away and confusing them about their capacity to vote. So the conservative and Republicans successful in perhaps confusing voters and disenfranchising some, but not as many as they had hoped. All right, speaking of courts and the law, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Nan Aaron, president of Alliance for Justice. We'll be right back after this. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Ting, ting.com, T-I-N-G. It's a new type of cell phone service. They have clarity and transparency in their billing. You don't get overbilled. You don't pay for minutes you don't use. You should check it out now. They offer 4G Android phones through Sprint. Ting means big savings. They got great support. You can call them from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And also, if you visit ting.com/majority report, you use their online savings calculator, you'll get $50 off any device you purchase from them. That's ting.com/majority report. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to the to welcome. Well, I guess back to the program in its most largest form, I guess. Nan Aaron, she is the president for the Alliance for Justice and also, I guess, a contributor to The Nation magazine.
Yes, we just worked with The Nation to put out an issue devoted to the Supreme Court. But before we go into that, it's a pleasure to be on this show again. So thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us. So now let's start with the new session that is starting of the Supreme Court. I guess it just started yesterday. And
yes.
And what are the biggest cases that we can expect to see in front of the court, and then we can talk about how nervous we are about these cases.
Well, most commentators who have written or discussed the court have focused on the fact that this term promises to be a very important one for civil rights. And we haven't had one of those kinds of terms in quite a while. And that's because we have a huge case coming up in a week or so involving affirmative action, race and classrooms, which we'll get to in a second. We've got what we think will be a case challenging the Voting Rights Act, and that is probably the single most important civil rights statute ever enacted. And third, we've got a case that will probably be taken by the Supreme Court involving the Defense of Marriage Act, which is a critically important case for, I was going to say, gays and lesbians, really, but for all of us in this country. So we've got three blockbuster cases coming up. And yesterday we heard a very important case, too, in Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, involving whether individuals who are tortured and actually killed abroad can sue a corporation for having been in cahoots with the torturers and killers in the country of Nigeria. It turns out some of those plaintiffs have now sought asylum here in the country and are sued Royal Dutch Petroleum for human rights abuses. So this promises to be a very, very significant term.
Yeah. All right. So let's go back and start with that, with the Fisher UT case, the University of Texas. It's right. It's Fisher is the plaintiff.
That's right. That involves a white student who was denied admission to the University of Texas in Austin. Turns out that the school admits the top 10% of academic performers from all Texas high schools. And then after it selects those students, it then considers the race of applicants as a factor in admitting the remainder of an incoming freshman class. Fisher didn't finish in the top 10% of her high school and claims that consideration of race cost her a spot on the university.
Now, my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's about 8 or 9 other factors that UT considers when they're looking at an applicant. And in fact, there were white students, and she argues that she did better than some African-American students who got in terms of her academics. But there's also some white students that she did better than that also got in, which suggests that the race of these applicants was not enough of a factor to keep her out. Is that how simple the case is? Is there more complication to it? Have I characterized it accurately?
I think you have, and as you've said, and no, race is just one factor in many in considering who will be admitted. So the fact is that as I think simple as this may appear to you and me, I think danger lurks within because we now have a few justices on the court who are very hostile to racial preferences and to even considering race as a factor. Those two new justices or newish justices are the Chief Justice John Roberts and Samuel Alito. So I think there's cause for concern. And Elena Kagan is not going to be participating in this case. So I think there's some worry.
Why is she recusing herself? Did she deal with this as a Solicitor General?
Yes, exactly. Okay. She probably had something to do with the case when she worked at the Justice Department. So none of us knows what will transpire, but I think there is cause for concern. When Samuel Alito replaced Sandra Day O'Connor, who actually came around late on the court to be a supporter of racial preferences, I think with Samuel Alito taking her place, I think it makes it less likely that the cause of civil rights will be upheld. But you know, we don't know. The fact remains, though.
Well, Nan, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't mean to interrupt, but let me ask you this. So, what are the implications of this? Because it seems to me this is one of those cases where you know you're talking about admissions into a university. This is the sort of the loosest, I guess, the most digestible for those people who have a problem with these things, digestible application of this concept. The idea that we believe as an educational institution that we provide a better education to our students if we can guarantee a certain amount of diversity of thought, of socio and economic backgrounds, that we're doing our best as an educational institution in looking at all these different factors. I mean, presumably, if the majority, they had an overwhelming number of an African American applicants, that the racial makeup of any given student might help them if they were white. And that's not an impossible, thing to imagine in the future, that it may be beneficial to the idea of diversity if the student is white. So what are the implications if this gets overturned in this context?
Well, I think what you're saying is that the country has really come to accept the kind of system that Texas has instituted. Interestingly, briefs have been filed by a whole host of corporations, the military, historians. So I think if, in fact, the Supreme Court bars racial preferences, it will do two things. One, it's really a signal that this court, instead of trying to continue the steady advancement of civil rights, human rights in our country, is turning the clock back and asking all of us, or forcing all of us, to refight those battles that we thought were won. And I would say, too, which is raised by your comments, and that is that the court will find itself on the wrong side of history if it bars these preferences. So I think it would be very, very unfortunate if that were the case.
Are there other policy implications? In other words, once they find these racial preferences in the context of college admissions to be unconstitutional, well, what are the implications for every other arena where there may be some type of racial preference? Minority awarded contracts from the government, say, or any laws that basically say you can't redline certain neighborhoods. I mean, is there, how far will this go?
Well, I think, as you just said, I think the implications are vast. But, you know, let's not fool ourselves here. We have a Chief Justice who was confirmed to this court, who had a record of, again, as I indicated, hostility to civil rights. As a young lawyer in the Reagan administration, he had filed briefs in opposition to civil rights, human rights. This is an individual who has spent a lifetime attempting to roll back our hard-won gains in this area. So I think we're already, Sam, on notice. We saw it in the Seattle and Louisville busing cases. We've seen it when he signaled a few years. I think we have a sense as to where he's going. I guess the question is, we don't know where Anthony Kennedy is, although I should say Unfortunately, he's never voted in favor of racial preferences either. So I think we're all keeping our fingers crossed and hope those arguments go well and hope these justices think long and hard before rendering a decision.
You know, we should also say, I just want to point out, too, with the Roberts, when he was preparing those briefs that were hostile to the idea of affirmative action, that in at least a couple of those instances, these were not requests for briefs. Like,
right.
He went out, he was out ahead of the administration on this. This is not
right.
a situation where you're working as an attorney and your client says, I need X, Y, or Z. He was pushing for policy changes in this instance. So we should make that clear. Let's talk about the attacks on the Voting Rights Act, because now, of course, we're cutting a little closer to the bone. They're going to address whether or not is it that certain states need to have pre-approval from the Department of Justice? Is that the issue?
Right. At the moment, there are 9 states who need to get prior approval from the Department of Justice before they make any changes to election procedures. That entails anything from redrawing congressional district boundaries to changing the location of polling places. And that's based on a history of discrimination. That's why the Voting Rights Act was passed. This is an act that was passed in 1965. It's been renewed 4 times as recently as 2006. And I think we should note this is a law that has been recently renewed with overwhelming majority of Democratic and Republican members of Congress. So this is an act that enjoys enormous approval in this country. And at the moment, there is a petition for cert that's been filed asking the court to, at this point, this is a challenge to the Voting Rights Act. We expect the court to make some kind of decision at the end of October, early November, as to whether it's going to hear this case. And what the challengers are saying is that some of the localities have already made substantial reforms, and therefore they don't need to be singled out for having to go to the Justice Department for prior approval. However, as we've seen now in this country with a whole host of laws and that have been enacted just recently that would limit voting and intimidate voters from exercising the franchise, that basically there is an ongoing effort in this country, principally by the Republican Party, to bar certain voters from going to the polls. So it's problem is very much alive and well, I think.
Don't we see evidence of that? That you know, I guess it was maybe a month or so ago, a federal court basically said that Texas has a problem with their redistricting, and this is disenfranchising voters. I mean, so it seems to me like the court system itself has already sort of established this is an ongoing problem. Is it, in other words, the if there are just simply is there room for this court? And again, I know this court, there, you know, I'm operating under this myth, and we'll talk about this when we talk about your piece, but that there really is any principles that really fundamentally guide a court like this in any real way. But when you have lower federal courts already basically saying, like, hey, we find this as to being this new voting plan you have to be racially discriminatory, that it intentionally disenfranchises specific voters based upon their ethnic background, or isn't that almost sort of like on its face evidence that we still need this?
I certainly think so, and I think, again, the past, yes, it's not just federal courts that are very plainly saying there is a need for this statute. There are a whole host of violations occurring. Yeah, I think there is a need, and I think many of us will be watching to see what the Supreme Court does, to see whether or not it takes up this case. And if it does, I think there's a very serious concern that the only reason the court would have accepted this case is to limit the reach of the Voting Rights Act. So, I mean, I think we wait and see what will happen, but I don't think that optimism prevails in this instance at all.
All right, so let's get into – I want to get into your piece in The Nation because, you know, this is – there has been – and, you know, now I've noticed this for going on nearly 10 years of doing political talk and in talking to progressives I think I'm inclined to perceive the importance of the Supreme Court a little bit more because I was raised by a pack of lawyers, but on the left have done we seem completely disconnected into the relevance of the court. And, you know, when we talked about the cases that are going to come up, the Royal Dutch Petroleum case is not exactly a social issue, but we're talking about social issues. But there's such a wide ranging number of issues that are affected by the court. Why is it that those of us on the left don't seem to really be plugged into the relevance of the court?
Well, I would say that is changing. We just completed a poll that shows, in fact, that the issue of Supreme Court nominations is a very significant issue, and that it will be a very important consideration to people's voting this year. That is a big change. I think 2 years ago, 4 years ago, you would have seen poll results showing very little interest in the court. I think the positive thing is that people are more and more aware of what the court is doing and how the court's decisions are affecting their lives. I think that's because of two important cases. One is Citizens United. It was a wake-up call to people, particularly those in states which have our battleground states, which are just getting a torrent of ads on the radio, TV, about the election. I think Americans are now aware that because of a Supreme Court decision, anytime they turn on the radio or TV, their experiences are incredibly uncomfortable and different from what they were before the election. And two, I think the decision on the Affordable Care Act, or affectionately known as Obamacare, was also another instance where people realized, whoa, Supreme Court's important. They're going to decide the constitutionality of a statute that affects my life, my health care, whether or not I can get insurance. So I think we are becoming, we're waking up to the fact that the court is really important.
Do you think it's important that those of us on the left also sort of parlay the awareness of these of the court's importance in these issues to also an awareness in terms of the sort of like the I don't know, the corporatist creep on the court? I mean, I think I saw a panel with you and Professor Carlin. Maybe it was at Netroots a couple of years ago. I can't quite remember where it was, but she made the argument that the court has moved to the right in every pick,
yes,
in every replacement since I think it was the 1950s. And
yeah, I think that's right. That's right.
And much of that movement has also come on the side of, you know, sort of to benefit corporations versus the individual, and You know, this is an issue even with the judges that we perceive to be in the liberal voting bloc. I mean, we never hear about the 7-2 decisions that actually liberals lose there, too. We just don't hear about those because it's not 5-4.
Right. Well, I think one of the points you're making is that we have a court that has increasingly shifted its opinions in favoring big business at the expense of everyday people. We've just produced a film. It's on our website, and it will be out next week, which talks about the Walmart case, which now prevents women, people of color, from banding together to bring class action suits and discrimination cases. We feature individuals who are now, because of a Supreme Court case, unable to sue generic drug companies when they experience harmful side effects. We also show the case of Citizens United, but it's case after case where this court has sided with big business. And it's not just the decisions, but we're also seeing the Chamber of Commerce, which is now much more active in Supreme Court litigation. It's the second most frequent litigator in the Supreme Court, the first being the Solicitor General. And in the 8 cases in which the court reached the merits of the issue, briefed by the National Chamber Litigation Group, the chamber won all 8. Mm. So this is a court which has moved decidedly not just to the right, but is finding time and time again and upholding the rights of large corporations. Very, very worrisome trend for all of us in this country.
So is the plan basically to engage the left with these social issues? I mean, that's sort of been what the right has done, right? I mean, they rally people around the people on the right, I think, have are far more sensitive to the implications of the court, basically because of things like abortion, you know, I guess burning the flag or... I'm trying to think of different, maybe affirmative action, sort of, in some ways, and then of course they also managed to get these, you know, these corporatists on, even like I say, even on those, even to the extent that we have a left wing voting bloc there, is the game plan to parlay that ultimately? I mean,
I think the game plan is through the Alliance for Justice's film, our work, this wonderful nation issue, which has many really illustrious writers producing articles. It's to build a constituency of activists who make the courts a priority, the same way that activists on the right, as you say, because of abortion, because of school prayer, flag burning, have made the courts an issue. So certainly one plan is to continue to build among our base of environmentalists, workers, and others, a core group of people who will fight for better judges and better courts, and two, to help identify and recruit individuals for judgeships from public interest backgrounds, civil rights backgrounds, public defenders. Find individuals who will begin to reassert some balance on these courts of appeals as well as the Supreme Court, so that we can replace some of the lost voices of, remember, Thurgood Marshall, William Brennan, so that we've got a voice back on these courts for individuals who care about human rights and civil rights.
What do you think accounts for on the left there, and you know, following the Supreme Court decision of 2000 that basically provided the presidency for President Bush at that time. It seemed to me that there was a real opportunity for the left to sort of reorient themselves in the way that they perceived the court. And it didn't seem to have happened. Now, part of that, I think, was actually because of 9/11 in some respects. But, you know, when I think back, like, you know, a guy like, let's say, Russ Feingold, who was very much an institutionalist in terms of the Senate, would almost as a principle, not fight against a Supreme Court pick of a president, regardless of who that president was, because he felt it was the purview of the president to pick it. But then ultimately sees his marquee legislation, something that he obviously thought was constitutional, some type of campaign finance reform, more or less overturned in some respects by the court. Is there are we at a turning point where you see some of these sort of the those types of people who have held the court in such high regard, so much so that they would think it being untoward in some respects to perceive the court as a subject of activism? Has that changed at all?
Well, I do think we do need to hold senators, even friendly ones, accountable. But I think even more important than that is that we've got to cultivate and recruit champions of a progressive judiciary. In the tradition of the late Ted Kennedy, when Kennedy was in the Senate, he was a leader. He fought for really great judges, and he was always there to sound the alarm when he thought a particular nominee would take our country backward. And I think it's up to all of us to figure out who our next champions will be. We've got some wonderful senators on the Senate Judiciary Committee at the moment, and we've got to help them raise their voices even louder so that the new president, if it's Obama, hears that they care and they want the administration to make this a priority. And if it's Romney, then I think they've also have to raise their voices and serve notice that they're going to review his candidates very, very closely and carefully, and simply not confirm them because they're the president's nominees, but right. Will take great care in trying to discern what that nominee's views are.
Who should we be looking on the left? Who should we be looking to on the Judiciary Committee to be sort of carrying this torch?
Well, I think we've got two senators who have been there many years. That's Schumer and Durbin have been very, very good voices, loud voices on this issue. Patrick Leahy chairs the committee and is able to process nominees quite competently through the committee. We've got a newish senator, Blumenthal, Sheldon Whitehouse, and I think we're looking for some of the new senators to speak up and speak out a little bit more loudly in the future. After all, every 4 years, our country thinks about who the president should be. We think about who our Senate and House members should be during election time. We need our senators to continually remind Americans and voters just how important the courts are and the judiciary is, and to be willing to fight for good judges and oppose those who will only turn the clock back on our rights and liberties.
It would be nice to see the president also make a couple of recess appointments.
Yes,
frankly.
Well, we'll see. Yes, it's certainly not over. There are a lot of vacancies, nearly 100 vacancies on the federal courts at the moment. So much work needs to get done. And when you think about 100 vacancies, that's one-eighth of our judiciary.
Yeah, I mean, is there really any question that the president has sort of has been pretty weak in this respect? I mean,
well,
I understand. Listen, I understand the tremendous amount of obstruction that has been going on by the Republicans. But at one point, you realize this is happening, and you say, I got to fill the judiciary.
Right. Well, I do think this president has pledged to make judgeships a priority. But I do have to say, which gets back to this issue of the nation and particularly my piece, we cannot wait for the president to lead this battle. We are going to have to do it. And we being individuals, activists, all of us around the country are going to have to weigh in with this president and weigh in with our senators. The senators, not the House members, because it's the Senate that has a role in confirming judges. But I think we have to look to ourselves. If we want this president to do this and to be willing to fight harder than he's fought, then I think we've got to take it upon ourselves to communicate with him, tell him how important it is, recruit candidates, and get to work. And
isn't it a problem if a guy who was a constitutional law professor doesn't appreciate the importance of federal judges? I mean,
I actually think he does appreciate the importance. After all, his two Supreme Court justices, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, are first class on this court. I think he does appreciate it. I think it's incumbent, though, on all of us to let him know how much importance we ascribe to this issue.
Right.
I think it's really our job going forward.
I agree with that as well. Nan Arand, Aaron, the president of Alliance for Justice, thanks so much for taking the time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. I'm looking at, I got to get a new clock. Literally, look up at the clock, and it's not, it's just blank. It's a digital clock, and I don't know if the batteries have run out.
It's like fading, like you just
it's just, we're just
see
watching
it.
Time fade away. How apropos. Ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow there will be a show only for members, a members-only day. It'll be an archive show. We are putting that together as we speak. And then on Thursday, we will be back. Tomorrow night, we'll be the debate will be happening. I don't think we're going to be doing it live because I cannot leave my child tomorrow night because we have we've got a babysitter situation and we've got a spousal working situation. So, but in the future, we will cover at least one of the debates live. I want to remind you, you can support this program by becoming a member. I reminded of you that yesterday. None of you listened. So I don't know what to tell you. And as far as that guy who emailed me and said, it's rude of you to ask for members to say the word freeloader. Well, you, sir, if you're listening to this, we've got a big problem. You shouldn't even be listening to this show anymore. That's all I can say to you. In the better half of the program, we'll talk about that J.P. Morgan being sued. Also, a clip from Noam Chomsky on this eternal debate as to what to do about this election. I don't know that anybody's even still arguing that, but it's possible. One more reason in which Romney is marginally more evil than President Obama, for those of you who perceive it that way, is his position on torture. Don't we all miss that? And we just wrap it all up and just head back to the aughts. bring back that torture. Also, we'll talk more about the grand bargain. And King Bloomberg on testing. Apparently, according to his Royal Highness Bloomberg, if you are, there's just not that many really, really smart black and Hispanic kids in New York, I guess. That's really the only explanation. That and or, what are you going to do? Sorry. It's just not fair. I will make that clear in the better half of the program. Like I say, you can become a member at Majority FM. You can also support this program by giving us a good review on iTunes, buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link, buying Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop, fair trade, organic. For those of you on the freebie cast, check out our sponsors all this month. We've got some more sponsors. We may have an even more sponsors. And see you in the better half. Call us at 646-257-3920.
Hey.